Okay, we are back. You're listening to The Fan. This is Mike. We were talking before the break about how is best to amplify voices and how best to listen. But we're taking your calls now on the Woke Sports Ally Talk Radio Network. All right, let's see. We got Paul from Piscataway on the line. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing, Mike? First time, long time over here. Just love the show. So I gotta ask you guys. So Arthur Chu, where does Arthur Chu rank on the all-time list of allies? Because I got him somewhere between Charlie Clymer, but not quite to Tim Wise. And I taught my friends are busting my balls all the time, but they think, yeah, that's crazy. But for me, like, he's up there in that echelon. I want to hear what you guys have to say.
It's interesting, you know. In my opinion, you know, there are great allies, and then there are legendary allies. And the question is, does Arthur Chu belong in the legendary status? And in my opinion, he does not. Yes, he is a great ally. He has done some very wonderful things, raising awareness. He says he would watch gay pornographies to understand how women feel. But has he ever actually become a gay prostitute himself at the demand of a woman that he met online? In my question, that is what makes a legendary, an immortal ally.
Mike is totally wrong. Okay, so what Mike is talking about is what makes Arthur a lunch pail, 9-to-5 ally, the type of the truly the greats. The greats. We're talking about Atticus Finch, that level. And what makes Arthur great is he's not a hip-hop style diva ally who's always quote-tweeting and adding his own commentary like Chris Clue or some of these newer guys. He's in old-school mode. Maybe he was born in the wrong year, but he is up there. He is already legendary, and he is just hitting his prime. I hear about Arthur Chu. Guys tell me they come into WISCON and all these conventions. Arthur Chu is in the computer conferencing room jacking off to gay fuck team 5. That's the kind of guy he is.
You know, you guys are good, but I just respect you guys. But does he give his money to women? I don't know. You know, I hear things. I hear maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. I don't know, you know?
That's locker room talk. That's locker room talk. That's group DM talk. Arthur Chu gives more of his money to women than he does through payroll taxes.
Dog, he's in the conversation. He's in the conversation, but in my opinion, he has not reached an immortal level of allyship yet.
Oh, he is the conversation.
dog. You're wrong. Many of the most immortal allies of all time were much drier than Arthur Chu is. So I feel that it's holding him back if he were to just sort of dry out a little bit. He's very shiny, very wet surface. And that can be off-putting, offensive, if you will, to people that he is trying to form common ground with.
Okay, if your masculinity is so fragile that you can't give respect to a wet guy like Arthur Chu, then your masculinity is so fragile you had no business ranking the allies.
All right, we're going to be back. We're going to be ranking some of the most woke people out there and why you should never, ever respond to them unless you were willing to give them your money. We'll be speaking of giving you money. You're about to hear from our sponsor, Ray Moore and Flanagan. This is The Fan. We're talking on Ally Radio Sports Network.
Holy shit. That was so good.
Holy fuck.
That's amazing.
We just, like, barely remembered what we wanted to do.
It's Chapo, everybody. Roll it. Episode 20, everybody. 2-0. We're back. It's me, Will Menaker, joined by Felix Biederman.
Hey, everybody.
And Matt Chrisman.
Hey, forget about it.
It is the 4th of July weekend. Happy holidays, everybody. Happy birthday, America. Hope you guys are having a good time.
All I got to say about that is if it's the 4th of July, you know what? That means one thing and one thing only. You got to fuck. If you're not fucking on the 4th of July, get out of this country. This
poses a problem for me because I'm going to be at a family reunion.
Yeah, if you're an incel, like 38% of our listeners, according to the last market research round, shoot on your stomach. Just jack off. But do it harder than usual.
Happy 4th of July, everybody. We have a jam-packed show for you coming up. We had a incredibly in-depth conversation with Jordan Breen of the Sure Dog Network about Felix's passion, which is the weird and wild world of mixed martial arts and the UFC.
And I have to say, as a guy, I know a lot of you are listening to this, and you're a bunch of asthmatic incels and dorks and nerdlingers, and you're thinking, oh, sports, and you're rushing to turn off your feed. Trust me, I am not a UFC or MMA guy, and this is a fucking fascinating, awesome conversation. You will want to listen to it.
And that also goes for the 2.5 women who also listen to our show.
Yeah, we know that you especially don't like sports, but Jordan is a friend of mine. He's one of the best people writing about MMA today. He hosts Cheap Seats and Press Row, like probably the two fucking best MMA podcasts. And he has a fascinating insight on probably the weirdest sport in the world. Insight no one else has, and we had a fucking amazing time talking to him. So please enjoy this and enjoy Jordan's shows.
Between Jordan and Felix, you guys have like probably the two greatest minds on the sport meeting together on Chapo Trap House. So I think we should go straight into that, and then after we will all be discovering whether we live in a bubble, according to race scientist godfather Charles Murray. It's going to be ill. It's the 4th of July. Let's do it. Jordan Breen. Okay, so we are joined right now by Jordan Breen of SureDog.com, who's here to talk to us about MMA with Felix. Now, speaking for myself, I probably know more about cricket than I do about MMA. But we wanted to have him on because Felix wrote, you wrote just an article for Deadspin this week, the title of which was, "Why Are So Many MMA Fighters Truthers, Conspiracists, and Just Plain Weird?" Now, I know if you're familiar with Chapo Trap House, sports is not something that we've touched on.
I like to call it sports ball.
But at the same time, I feel like even though you're not familiar with sports, if you're a fan of Chapo Trap House and you have the same mental illness that we do, you realize that everything is political. Indeed, yes. Even sports, and especially MMA. So, Felix, you wrote this article that sort of takes us through the world of MMA and some of the more colorful characters therein. And I'd just like to read one section. You write, "What is it about wearing 4-ounce gloves that causes a person to talk about how Egyptians had space shuttles 4,000 years ago and warn that Jade Helm is coming any day now?" So, Jordan, Felix, what is it about MMA that attracts this certain type of personality?
Well, first, I think you hit on it. It was a very important tenet of it. And although MMA's fan base is diversified, and myself, you know, like I'm a huge sports fan, but I think one secret or less talked about piece of MMA's success in going mainstream over the last decade in the West is that it really has been a sport for people that never had a sport. I think it would be maybe a bit obtuse to simply paint it as, oh, a bunch of pro wrestling fans got to go, oh, it's real. No one will make fun of me if I like this instead of WWE. But it's, I think, a more exaggerated version of that. It's a sport that tends to get people to respond if they've never responded to another sport before. And I think there's something really essential to it. You know what I mean? There's a reason no one gives a shit about running for 4-year intervals. But the Olympics comes up. Man, who's the fastest man? Can Usain Bolt moonwalk while eating chicken McNuggets to another world record? We thirst for these things. There's, you know, within fight or flight, there's two very essential human competitions. You know, biologically, when you look at the animal kingdom, can you move faster? Can you kill things? And until the purge becomes reality, MMA, boxing, prize fighting is the closest thing we're going to have.
Inshallah.
And I think when it comes to So, I mean, MMA speaks, I think, to part of the soul of a person. Like, I'm doing radio for like a decade now and being deeply immersed in MMA for like 18 years, I see the amount of people, not just, you know, martial artists who started training jiu-jitsu and loved it, but people who responded to MMA seeing it primarily because it seemed like their sport all of a sudden, and it was something that, you know, didn't really click with them before. On top of that, for, you know, some reasons that Felix can get to here, it is the misfits toy box of sports. I mean, prize fighting will always attract a certain kind of social outcast for the most part, these bizarre outliers and demonized folk of society, people, minorities, people from poor socioeconomic backgrounds, people who are essentially trying to fight their way out of poverty or trauma or tragedy. And when you go even deeper on that, mixed martial arts, it's a sport that proliferates in countries that have bizarre geopolitical makeups, instability. Never mind whatever you think of with America. Like, the other pillars of mixed martial arts are like Brazil, a place where they've had about 46 seconds of democracy in centuries, and well, places like Russia and Japan. So it's bizarre when, you know, someone's like, hey, did you see the Russian guy with the cat on John Oliver with the cat? And it's like, you got no idea about this guy putting on MMA shows where suicide bombers show up at the opulent nightclub after party and take out five people.
Well, yeah. Like, Felix, I know I've heard you say in the past that even more so than boxing, which, like you said, like any sport where you are punching people and taking blows to the head repeatedly is going to attract people from, like you said, more unstable backgrounds, people who are fighting to get out of something. And this is like that's the way out, you know. But Felix, you said even more so than that, MMA does attract a kind of a loner type.
Hold on one second.
Oh, shit.
Someone is calling.
Oh, the money phone's blowing up. I also love how it has like a shitty burner type ring to it. It's this old jangly like Nokia brick kind of.
Don't worry, Felix. Somebody.
The Chicago River after this conversation.
Felix, pick up the phone and start talking. Let's just record this. I want to see what happens.
I think my mom picked it up. My mom picked it up to talk to the West Side.
Yeah, that's so funny. okay. We need to leave all this in. That's right. The most fail something we've ever recorded.
Yeah, we need.
No, dude,
Felix is recording out of his mom's bedroom.
Dude, I'm fucking Rupert Pumpkin in the King of Comedy.
Mom, I'm trying to do this. You got the cardboard cutouts of everybody sitting around a table.
Basically, what I was saying is that I know I've heard you say in the past that even more so than boxing. Like, which attracts people who are generally come from a poorer background and are fighting, as Jordan said, to get out of something. It's their ticket, you know, out of poor circumstances. MMA attracts even more of a kind of a loner type to it than even boxing does. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, boxing in a lot of ways it's a class thing. You can trace it back, like, you know, a while ago, back before we figured out Jewish stereotypes and we decided that all Jews were like nebbishy creatures who suck their tentacles all through the banking system of the world and like are all 4 feet tall and shit. The idea was that Jews were like just like feral sexual desert creatures, and one of the reasons that people thought that was that Jews were like they dominated boxing, and this was a class thing, and it was a thing for recent immigrants in America, was that you went into boxing because this was seen as a way out. Boxing, you know, as fucked up as USA Boxing, the amateur league, is, there is an established system for boxing. There are established feeder gyms. There is this existing system in place that has been there for quite some time. Whereas with MMA has only been legal for, like, in America for, you know, fully sanctioned for, like, less, you know, shorter than I've been
alive. They just legalized it in New York this year.
Yeah, like, yeah. We'll get to Local 226 and their efforts as well. But to Felix's point, like, the not that MMA isn't full of poor people. It is. And as we'll talk about with labor stuff, you could argue that a lot of the MMA middle class are poor people as well, unfortunately. But when you – like, in other countries where there is a different infrastructure around the sport, Brazil – It's not uncommon for a mid-level Brazilian prospect to catch a UFC deal. He gets a $50,000 bonus one night. This guy can actually buy a bus pass and eat every day. And he starts balling out of control. But in America, if you're boxing, and you're some poor kid. You go to a gym. You're probably part of like an after-school program. You're maybe not paying anything. You're probably getting free instruction. If you show a flash, you kind of get the ability to go up to the amateur ranks. People want to coach you. Eventually, if you're going to the Olympics, you're meddling, you're going to get pro promoters around you that are throwing money at you and want to be your guy. In mixed martial arts, the barrier to entry is higher. I mean, MMA in the West and in a lot of other places too, but definitely like in America, Canada, it's a middle-class sport. Europe, same thing. It's a middle-class sport for the most part because you go to take MMA or do jiu-jitsu. Yo, Felix, what are jiu-jitsu rates like in New York City?
Yeah.
How do you like paying to go to Henzo's or Marcelo Garcia's? Oh, you think they're giving that shit away for free?
No, it's fucking great. It's hundreds of dollars a month, even more than it is like in Chicago or Minnesota. And what Jordan talking about the class politics of MMA in Brazil is interesting because people, like the American idea of Brazil is that everyone's in the favela and hanging out, but Brazil has some of the most dramatic income equality even for South America. And sort of before modern MMA, we saw this play out where there was a series of gym fights and arena fights and just full-out street brawls in Brazil between Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioners and people who practiced another art called Lucha Livre Deportivo. And the reason this happened is, okay, to do jiu-jitsu, you had to be middle class because you had to buy a fucking uniform. You had to pay for the gym, which was more expensive than anything. And the sport of jiu-jitsu was sort of propagated in Brazil by kind of an aristocratic family, the Gracies, who are
kind of,
yeah, pretty. They're like the fucking Saudi royal family. They have like 50 kids and all name them wacky shit. And they're just lunatics.
The Gracie lunatics. Family, just this bizarre, like, medieval fiefdom, these bullshy, swaggering, disproportionately rich folk with these enormous gyms everywhere.
Yeah,
and in classic upper middle class fashion too, as soon as you get past the first few generations that laid the foundation for jiu-jitsu and honor in the Gracie way, as soon as you get to like the third and fourth generations that have money, they're all either complete raving lunatic street fighters who are just like taking out their weird familial rage on people in the streets, or they're complete pacifists who are like, dude, why would I want to fight? Everyone in my family's rich as shit. I just got to put my pajamas on, roll around a few hours a day.
Yeah,
they call that the Habsburg parabola.
Yeah, I can't wait for Horian the Accursed, who needs people to put on his gi for him so he can place fifth in the game.
But I wanted to know though, during that fight, you said there was this big battle, class war between people who did different martial arts styles. Where were the capoeira people?
Capoeira ends up kind of getting more on the lucha libre side. And going back to the class thing, the lucha libre guys are the first ones that really embrace cross training. They want to learn how to be better wrestlers. They want to go to a boxing gym and figure out how to box and these sorts of things. When you look at the oldest tenured sort of like boxing gyms and striking gyms in Muay Thai gyms in Brazil, they have longer traditional associations with lucha libre and other styles that competed against jiu-jitsu. And I mean,
just to break in for a second, to be clear to our listeners who perhaps don't know, when you say jiu-jitsu as opposed to like boxing, cross training and striking, jiu-jitsu is primarily like closer to what we would think of as wrestling, right?
I mean, imagine judo with extended what they call niwaza ground techniques. In judo, if you end up on the ground, you're going to get stood up fairly quickly. Submissions on the ground for the most part, takedown standing obviously, but the emphasis is to immobilize, positionally dominate, and then eventually submit or render your foe incapacitated. But because the Gracies are the pillar of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, they are the royal family of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And you mentioned like capoeira, it's a slave art. It's, you know, it's disguised as dance. So these people working in the plantations, these poor Goan Indians or whoever got brought over on a slave ship, didn't have to reveal that they were planning on doing a 720 corkscrew kick into their plantation master's mouth. So the class associations of pretty much every other martial art lined up in such a way that they align to sort of compete against Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. Although eventually Jiu-Jitsu athletes, especially as you get into the the late 70s, early 80s are cross-training a bit more seriously.
I mean, what Joe...
Felix, go ahead.
What Jordan said about cross-training, and it used to be that the jiu-jitsu people were more purists, and you still get a bit of that with the older generation, the Gracie family, who they'll watch an MMA fight and be like... Like the guy, whatever guy, like gets on top of another guy, suffocates him, and just beats the living shit out of him. The Gracie guy will go, well, that guy sucks because he's not doing jiu-jitsu right, which is like sort of a who gives a shit type thing. But there is a very big class element in sort of the art purism of martial arts, because it's if you go to your like there are these weird racial politics when you go to Europe with European judoka, people who practice judo. Now, you guys know Taki. Our listeners probably know Taki from Taki Mag, the famous shipping
who founded Taki Mag, which hosts Gavin McGinnis.
Jim Gove, yeah. Just a murderer's row of shitheads.
Yeah, yeah. The Hollywood Walk of Fame of phrenology. But so Taki is a judo player. Taki hates MMA. Do you know why they hate MMA? They hate MMA because the European judoka, when they would compete in judo, what would happen is they would compete against Chechens, Dagestanis, and just ethnic Russians who had washed out of wrestling. They weren't good enough to be in their national wrestling programs and would just fucking double. They wouldn't tug on the pajamas and do a fancy throw. They would just grab your legs and fucking slam these aristocrats into the mat.
I feel like there's a stereotype among like rich white assholes in this country if they get their ass kicked in like a bar fight or something is to say, I just didn't have the chance to use my wrestling. I would have dominated if it ended up on the ground because he just got like laced in the face three times. Yeah, like.
But that also plays into one of the great things about mixed martial arts is because of the variability of it. You have these tiny ass gloves. You know, I won't say anything can happen, but the ways in which you can attack in mixed martial arts are, you know, based on the modalities of what we consider professional prize fighting for centuries, pretty unrestrained. You get these bizarre outcomes, literally. And I've tried to make him a cult hero of my radio programming and writing over the last decade. One of my all-time favorite mixed martial arts stories is there's this guy, Benji Raddick, who's good MMA veteran for years at 170, 185. He's a UFC veteran at the time. He's probably one of the best 15 welterweights on earth at 170 pounds. He ends up getting into a relationship in his home state of Washington with a girl who apparently is dating a local tough guy boxer from just a family of low-rent, white trash tough guy boxers. A whole family called the Lefevers. This dude, Danny Lefever, is like a 5'2", just put it this way, the subtext or the epilogue to this is that Danny Lefever most recently, I believe he had a bunch of like traffic tickets or just some kind of ne'er-do-well kind of political charge. He ended up doing time, actually getting sent to jail because instead of actually doing his probation and community service, he sent his brother, who I'm not sure if it's his twin brother, but apparently looks just like him, like sent his brother to do his community service. And then put him in jail. So like that's the kind of family we're dealing with here.
Dude,
so
he is UFC a hero.
Veteran, this UFC veteran, Benji Raddick, and to point out, this isn't like 1993, like people don't know how to fight yet. This is 2003. The unified rules of mixed martial arts have been established. MMA's not as good as it's going to get, but if you're fighting MMA professionally and doing well, you know how to fight. So, He ends up having this fight with Danny Lefever in 2003 over a girl. Literally like, oh, you're trying to get fresh with my girl. So Benji Raddick's trainer, Dennis Hallman, another longtime UFC veteran, a dude that fought for a UFC title, they put on a show in, I think, Spokane, Washington, if I'm not mistaken, Longview, Washington, at the Cowlitz County Fairgrounds, and they literally hyped this thing as active UFC veteran Benji Raddick is going to fight 0-0, no pro MMA fight, Danny Lefever, this local tough guy boxer in a beef over a girl. And people thought this was the most preposterous dude. This is – Benji Raddick is going to kill this poor dude. He's like 5'2". Like what the fuck is this? They fight. Benji Raddick throws one leg kick. Danny Lefever clearly has no idea how to check a leg kick. He goes flying halfway across the ring. This thing looks like it's going to be over imminently. And just in a moment of cuckolded rage, Dane LeFevre spazzes forward at Benji Raddick and just savagely punches him up and knocks him dead in the middle of the Cowlitz County Fairgrounds. And the entire place goes batshit. Dane LeFevre never fought another MMA fight after. Benji Raddick has spent the last 12 years as still a respectable MMA veteran. And testifying to what a probably unsavory dude Dane LeFevre is and is as a partner, the girl, despite her boyfriend at the time smashing him in the face, left and went with Benji Raddick.
Oh.
But this dude
ain't loyal.
Yeah, so like Benji Raddick has to look at this girl forever and just be like, yo, it's great that we're together, but remember when this 5'2" local criminal beat me in the face in front of all of our friends and family?
Okay, Jordan, thank you so much for this, because look, if you've been listening to the show, you know one of our running segments is the Chapo screenplay fund. Yes. And drive, where we just keep adding to that pile.
The Danny LeFevre story.
The Danny LeFevre story. It's like those movies where like Mark Wahlberg played that guy who was like a walk-on to the Eagles. It'll be like that, but the really seedy, fucked up version.
Dude, but this shit happens everywhere. Like one of the great, like, and again, like it's not like he's not an Olympic silver medalist in boxing, but Ray Mercer's damn near 50. Takes an MMA fight with two-time UFC heavyweight Tim Sylvia. Even if his manager famously called him polio legs because he was like 6'8" and had a body like Big Baby Huey, Tim Sylvia is still one of the 10 best MMA heavyweights ever. And Ray Mercer, who was just decrepit, and they had to take the fight to Alabama because no one else would sanction it, and Alabama at the time didn't even have an athletic commission. Ray Mercer one-punches him in under 10 seconds. That's why, like, MMA is just the freakiest, dumbest carnival show sport. It is real pro wrestling in the sense that when you think about what pro wrestling started as, this touring big top freak show with outcasts and misfits and strongmen and tough people who wanted to make a buck. That is all it is now. It just has political backing and huge financial infrastructure. That's it. It is still the closest you can get to P.T. Barnum and just the rattling of the stick and the swill bucket for you to see, you know, the bearded lady or whatever the case might be.
For me a little bit, because Jordan talking about how, you know, in the United States we think of it, I know I thought of MMA as sort of a refuge for poor people, and you're pointing out that it's actually a lot of middle class people. It gives more of a vision of not necessarily just people who are sort of on the margins, but also like the kid who like dropped out of high school because he spent the whole time like drawing Slayer album covers on his notebook instead of listening to class.
Yeah, so Felix will assuredly appreciate the direction I'm about to take this conversation, and obviously it's your show, so post, you can take it in whatever direction that you want. But, you know, UFC 200's coming up, a big monumental UFC event, simply because they say so, even though it's not their 200th event in any shape or form. But nonetheless, July 9th, they have a big, exquisite event. On the undercard of this, There's a young, adorable, moderately powerful Pokemon, 20-year-old, fresh-faced Sage Northcutt, who, yo, you guys always talk about having the Google image search open right now? Will. Matt.
All right,
please go to
the
image
now.
Search and search Sage
you
Northcutt.
You have to see him.
Teases.
You have to fucking see him. He's okay. Perfect. He's our perfect boy. But Sage Northcutt is different from anyone in MMA, because you go on his Twitter, like, okay, so we had MRSA the other month. Which is, you know, for people who don't know, is a blood infection you get from unclean training conditions. And he posts these videos from the hospital because he's unrelentingly positive, to the point where he makes a YouTube bodybuilder look like fucking like Rust Cole. he posts this video in the hospital where he goes, what's up, everybody? I got MRSA. Please pray for me. Bye. And he's drinking a protein shake.
So basically, he's like one of those teen Vine stars, like Jacob Sagittarius
or whatever. He's not like that at all, because here's the thing. Teen Vine stars are these are clearly kids that have freedom. And Sage Northcutt, it may not surprise you, his dad is quite an interesting character. This is not – so one of the things that makes Sage Northcutt just – the MMA media loves it. Even though he's been disproportionately pushed and it was not ready for prime time. Like, the UFC has co-opted this kid and made him a star with very limited experience.
He lost his last match, right?
Yeah, and did so in fashion which demonstrated a overwhelming lack of preparedness on the ground. This is not one of the best 50 lightweights on earth or anything like that. However, this is a kid that has been pushed ruthlessly from the day he was born to do things. I'll get to more of his dad in a second, but on the social media tip, they are hardcore crazy Christians. And even though he's tried to deflect it with the MMA media, like, it's a real thing that apparently, like his internet activities, like, he's 20 years old. Like, he's not allowed to, like, fully, like, browse the internet, or at least till very recently. He was only allowed to use the internet for, like, academic purposes. By the way, he's studying petroleum engineering at the Texas A&M, obviously, being good, a good suburban.
To have something to fall back on.
Well, that's the thing. You see his house. It's his big palatial suburban Texas estate. He, like, has a Vine or Instagram, but, like, washing his giant truck.
It's ridiculous. Like, it's like if somebody took Johnny Manziel and gave him a lobotomy when he was, like, 14.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah, dude,
yes, that is exactly what it's like. Only this father, Mark Northcutt, his father basically did the Tim Allen. He was popped in, like, the late 80s, early 90s with a ton of steroids and cocaine and just ratted on everyone to avoid doing any kind of serious time. And then, obviously, one of the weird things with this kid is everyone looks at him and is like, yo, are you on steroids? Like, you've done, you know, junior bodybuilding since you were, like, 10, and your dad was a steroids dealer. And, like, it's possible that this dude's not even aware that his dad has done this shit in the past.
It's 100%.
I've never – if he was a method actor, he would be the greatest method actor I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah, like –
he has exchanges with the media which don't even seem real, because it's hard to sort of reconcile the idea that this man is able to – this child, even if he's 20, this man-child is able to beat up grown men in the octagon, and yet his entire life is just this bizarre blend of, like, training, doing pitches for Labrada Nutrition, and – shooting off potato guns on the 4th of July.
Yeah, there's no one like him. The only thing I can compare him to is if you took a Faulkner character and gave him Anabar, and you see him, and MMA fans, their first reaction, they hate anyone who is unfairly pushed. This is why so many people hated Kimbo for so long, Kimbo Slice for so long, in addition to existing racial animus. But
that's a wrestling thing too,
right? But my thing with Sage is, like, I want to protect him from I don't want him to find out about girls. I don't want I want to protect him from the
third
world.
The third picture on his Instagram right now is a picture with him or with his arm around. He's actually sitting near a cocktail cabinet of Centipede or something like that, or multicade. So he's sitting near a multi arcade cocktail table, probably just in his basement collecting dust in this just richy rich Texas suburban hell mansion. But he's got his arm around a cutout of the world's most interesting man, and the caption is simply, "Finally got to meet the world's most interesting man." LOL.
Yeah, no, like he's
and it is almost a dead certain that he has never tasted alcohol before.
Oh, no, it's 100% possible. Like, we usually, like, make fun of a libertarian guy, like the bow tie guys, who are like, I've never tried a drug. But it's like, I really believe it with Sage. There is – the other day – so he's always posting pictures of him doing mundane activities but nearly naked, because he has, like, a 12-pack. Like, he looks, like, computer-rendered. So the other day he posted a picture of him washing his giant F-150. And his shirt's off, and, like, the sun's out.
That fucking truck His truck must literally be like the cleanest truck in all of Texas. Yeah. As he appears to wash it every 12 hours.
Yeah, because he's like fucking, he's MMA Flanders. But so Tesha Torres, she's a female UFC fighter, pretty attractive woman, and she tweets at Sage when he posts, of course, a shirtless picture of him washing trucks. She goes, "Me next," like trying to flirt with him. And Sage goes, "Okay, where's your truck at?" he's fucking amazing. I love him.
Well, this is good, actually. So Sage Northcutt, let's go through some of these characters specifically that is mentioned, that Felix brings up in his article. You open the article with Tito Ortiz, and you say, "In late May, Tito Ortiz made a public appearance at a Donald Trump rally, holding up a bumper sticker that read, 'Hillary Clinton killed my friends.'"
Tito Ortiz is the, well, 99% of success is failure, and 99% of failure is success. And if you don't learn how to fail to succeed, you're never going to learn how to succeed at failing. But like,
Jerry Jameson, you whore, give me my kids back.
Yeah.
So as Matt makes fun of Tito again for his ill-fated relationship with Jenna Jameson, if we're going to talk Tito really quickly, we should bring up this man's sexual pathology as well, since that is the kind
that's
of...
That's a specialty of our
that's
show.
Our shit,
yeah,
man.
Please go ahead.
That's what you guys are in it for. That's what the Grey Wolves are here for. So look at Tito's personal life. He's got kids with his ex-wife, his first wife, who by all accounts, they're on great terms. You know, they post like social media stuff of them doing stuff together with the kids. She speaks of him favorably in public and basically says, you know, he's a great dad. And also to that point, Tito's one of those dudes that just his dad status is paramount to him. If not paramount, it's way up there on the priorities list. The inordinate fuck this guy gives about showing off what a dope daddy is just, again, pathological in and of itself. He's got this great relationship with his ex-wife. And then, you know, his career starts slipping a bit. He's not as productive as he once was in the cage, but he's still a huge draw. The UFC blows up a bit. He thinks, man, I could date the hottest porn star from 8 to 10 years ago. I gotta do this. She looks absolutely positively ghoulish now. In no way resembles the fresh-faced, natural beauty girl next door type that got into the industry. I need to get with Jenna Jameson. Their relationship ends in pure toxicity, obviously. And in turn, what does he do? Begins dating old flame Amber Nicole Miller, one of the original ring girls from when Zuffa first bought the UFC and started, you know, taking ring girls more seriously.
Well, the only guy I was going to bring up next, this guy, Tim Kennedy.
Oh, wow.
He's a former Army Ranger. He's a former Army
Ranger. From what I saw from the article, he seems more like a teacot, right?
I'll let Felix take it and run with
he
this.
Seems like
I can
more
only
of a,
imagine
of a, the kind of guy who would be, you know, able to commiserate on a baseball team or a hockey team, like a good old fashioned, you know, paranoid white flight teacot.
You say that he appears on the Alex Jones show, and you describe his beliefs as a John Birch Society conspiracist who was cryogenically frozen and revived in the late 2000s.
That is exactly it. Tim Kennedy, I think of him as sort of the platonically perfect, like, not really Cruz voter, because he's not spectrum enough to be a Cruz voter, and he's not, like, the trans bathroom thing doesn't seem to be, like, as big of an animating factor for Kennedy. But I would say he's, like, the platonically perfect Rick Perry voter. And by that I mean he's as fervently and psychotically and pathologically anti-communist as you can be in the year 2016, to the point where the day of Nelson Mandela's death, he tweets, "A lot of people crying for Nelson Mandela. I'm not." And he posts a picture of Mandela behind a Soviet flag. And people, like, he's, you know, he's a former Army Ranger. He's a former sniper. He's just talks always in psychotic terms about protecting America from evil. It's sort of a throwback. It's the type of conservatism that we usually don't see. It's the type of Birchers who matriculated later into the later Bush years, the final hangers-on, who eventually became Rick Barry's dwindling base in his 2012 and 2016 runs. He's got a fucking t-shirt company that sells you, like, tacky t-shirts. The company's called Ranger Up, and they sell t-shirts with slogans like, the only time you'll be kneeling five times a day is when you're slumped over from my gun. Like, that's not a real shirt, but it's like that type of glibness and insanity.
Also, one thing that's Cheribo Kennedy is he's a soldier on all fronts, too. Like, he's someone who's not afraid to proselytize across the board in like a political or religious fashion. Felix, would you like the honor of explaining, before I get into Tim Kennedy's comment, would you like to explain the Yoel Romero gay Jesus conflict?
All right, so Yoel Romero fights...
Oh, it should also be... It should be pointed out before the gay Jesus thing as well. Prior to this, Yoel Romero secured essentially a bullshit victory over Tim Kennedy after Tim Kennedy knocked him out at the end of the second round. And then a mysterious Cuban trainer of Yoel Romero, like, loosely associated with American Top Team, came in and dumped a bunch of water in the cage. And Yoel Romero got, like, an extra minute to recover amidst much chaos, and then knocked Tim Kennedy out shortly afterwards. So they have prior existing beef, and then he gets on the microphone after Lyoto Machida. And what do you remember the exact quote,
Felix? Yoel Romero knocks out Lyoto Machida, once the previously thought of as untouchable UFC light heavyweight champion, who had moved down to middleweight, become a contender there. Yoel knocks him out cold, brutally. He gets on the mic. I want to remind you, this is the week that the Supreme Court struck down gay marriage bans in all 50 states. Yoel Romero. America, what happened? You know for gay. You know for gay Jesus. Come on.
So the claim of Yoel Romero, after some clever spin, is that he said, not forget Jesus. Or no, forget Jesus. Of course, what it very distinctly sounded like was no for gay Jesus, which instantly led into weird Twitter, but MMA Twitter is fundamentally another form of weird Twitter. And people just losing their shit to the highest degree. But what's good about Tim Kennedy in this situation is he is not at all mad that he got screwed against Yoel Romero previously. He's definitely not mad. In fact, finds it funny. So he instantly tweets him like, oh, no for gay Jesus? Well, I guess I have a different idea what it means to be a Christian.
You know, it shows that even Tim Kennedy is the closest thing besides this other guy. We could just do an entire show about his book. But besides Matt Hughes, the only standard forebearer of American conservatism in MMA. And because it's through the filter of the type of person who is MMA, not even that is the normal version of this already bizarre political system. It's a
You guys like to read. Aberrated, you know, just brought it up really quickly. That. Will, Matt, if you guys want insights into, again, high-level characters and the human tragic drama that is mixed martial arts, by all means, read Matt Hughes' Made in America. It's a breezy read in terms of structure. In terms of the weight of the content, if you're someone with a moral conscience, you will be absolutely floored. This man is this man is possibly one of the 10 best MMA fighters ever, until George St. Pierre was unquestionably the best welterweight ever, one of the winningest, fightingest dudes in UFC history, an outstanding mixed martial artist, by all accounts. As a man, His autobiography, which, again, he's working with a writer, but he's still offering up details of his life. The parts where his voice comes through the clearest, the parts where you can tell it's his words and not his co-authors, where he's really describing things from a position of clarity and passion, are exactly the sorts of things that if someone found out about you, you would typically be horrified and deny and cover up until the day you were in the dirt. The things that, like, the average person would be utterly ashamed of or feel absolutely rotten about admitting are the things that Matt Hughes revels in discussing and wears as a badge of honor, whether it's trying to badger former UFC heavyweight champion Tim Sylvia into suicide as a teammate, or discuss it, him and his brother, his twin brother Mark, beating up their father behind the barn for kicks, and while cutting up animals, throwing animals' entrails at each other while hunting as like a routine matter of course, and even basically admits to the statutory rape of his future wife and current wife.
Well, as it says, I'm actually looking at the jacket copy for Made in America, and it sums it up nicely at the end. A Christian, a family man, and a fighter. Matt Hughes could only have been made in America.
All right, so I wanted to briefly talk about the labor issues involving MMA. After this discussion, I think this just clarifies something that I already suspected, and that is that as much as MMA fighters desperately need to collectively bargain in order to get a better deal from the different promotions, it'll never happen. And it seems like one of the big reasons, in addition to the fact that a lot of these guys are sort of misfits who don't trust anybody, including their fellow fighters, is that all of their fellow fighters are guys that they have to punch in the face all the time.
And it's also a sport like boxing. There's a reason there isn't like a real boxers union the way that people want, even if they have the Muhammad Ali Act in place that's supposed to protect fighters and so often doesn't for a variety of reasons, even as people fight to bring the Ali Act to apply to mixed martial arts. Even with that, it's an insular sport. You know, MMA, you have more of a team-based system with large gyms, but you're still on your own in the cage, and you're an independent contractor. So it's not like you got a whole team of guys. You got, like, 52 other football players in the locker room, and you got traded from another place where you were real close with another 20 guys, and you all see each other at the Pro Bowl, and like, oh, man, like, this is bullshit. We got to do some stuff with the union. You know, the relationships in MMA, even for people who move around and train and travel the world and try to live a martial artist lifestyle, so to speak, and make that a part of how they compete as a fighter. These are people that may have relationships, but they're not the same kind of relationships that are bred in team sports. And because, like as you mentioned, Matt, like these are people that are punching one another in the face, and for the most part, even in a much more real sense, someone else's loss is your gain in a very major material way in mixed martial arts. It's not like a union's impossible, but there are so many factors in play that certainly try to undermine it just by the very structure of mixed martial arts as a competitive individual prize fight.
Well, actually, this leads into something I wanted to ask. A lot of the guys that we've talked about, in fact, all of them range from sort of Donald Trump support to the kind of Bercher side of things, but all this sort of weird and perverted American nationalism basically is the common denominator. And I'm wondering, is there anyone in the UFC or mixed martial arts world that comes at it from sort of a more left-wing perspective?
Oh, absolutely. One of the lesser known guys like this is Thiago Tavares, the UFC featherweight, a once hyped prospect who like never really amounted to what people thought he could amount to. But he ran for
good quality roster,
very
fighter.
Quality fighter, and very always exciting, win or lose. Usually, he ran for legislative office in Brazil as a communist. Jeff Munson, of course, who we're about to get into. Carlos Condit. Carlos Condit is reasonably lefty by American standards. It's not
also though to Matt's previous fantasies about just what happens when kids who have parents that can afford to put them in MMA classes and have, you know, a two-parent home and the kind of suburban rage that comes out of it. It's Carlos Condit.
Fuck yeah, it is.
This dude is upper middle class as shit. His dad's like a career politician. Like I mentioned, right-hand man for Bill Richardson during his governor run in New Mexico. And yet he has one of the most famous, insane, psychotic, thousand-yard pre-fight stares and is nicknamed the Natural Born Killer. And fights just fights like a kid who's like, my fucking dad took my fucking PlayStation. Yeah, he's just taking it out.
You know what? Here's how I describe Carlos Condit, to steal how John Dolan describes Paul Atreides. He is an aristocrat who will kill everybody around him if necessary. He's a deranged rich kid who produces some of the most fucking incredible
fights. He's like an evil medieval prince in some kind of period piece. For sure.
We want to clarify this is Condit in his fighting career. He seems like a completely normal, nice person.
Yeah, and that's another part of it too. He successfully pulls off one of the most genuine dualities. Normally in mixed martial arts, when people show sort of, you know, it's like the layers being exposed. It's not this sort of like platonic duality where there's like the fighter and the man. Typically, it's very obvious just in people's MMA exploits, kind of what they believe and maybe what they represent as people. And when they speak, certainly it's sort of normally commensurate with what they're like as fighters. Like, these things normally work in tandem. Condit is one of the just sweetest family dude, down to earth, you know, wants to talk about King of the Hill episodes and shit like that. Just sweetheart of a guy, and a great asset to the sport. A dude that could do politics himself like Pop.
Easily,
but,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but all of a sudden, you know, he puts a mouth guard and puts on 4 ounce gloves and listens to Rage Against the Machine doing a ring walk and turns into an absolute psychopath.
I guess just to bring things full circle, let me ask both of you guys, Felix and Jordan, in sort of analyzing fighters and the fight game, like what do you take from that that you think can be applied to a political context in arena?
Well, I think it's a good reminder at a time where, you know, like this election cycle in America is especially a good reminder of how easy it is for like wonks and pundits to misidentify what people's intentions are, what their beliefs are, sort of who they'd be expected to support, the way they sort of subdivide categories of voters. People constantly misunderstand and misrepresent these things. And the underlying theme is that these tend to be like rich beltway types that are divorced from like what people all over the country are like, and how truly different and really not at all homogeneous America is. And so MMA is, because it isn't just it crosses so many divides of economic and racial and national boundary, you end up with a more, if strange, you end up with a much richer sort of sense of the kind of people that exist in the world, what they believe in, what people are like, and what their intents and motivations can be. It's not typically, I think, it's a cauldron of strange people and often weird niche groups that otherwise you might not get to appreciate exist. And you get to study them up close in a high-pressure situation where ultimately they're going to punch someone in the face or get punched in the face themselves.
An authentic representation of American culture.
It's an international thing, too. The amount of stuff you pick up, I mean, we didn't even get deep into the caucuses, but you have, like, arguably the best lightweight on earth, Habib Nurmagomedov, hardcore Dagestani dude who had an absolute meltdown when in the EA Sports UFC video game, they gave him a Christian celebration. I think they had him crossing his chest. If you like knock someone out, he like celebrated and crossed his chest and pointed up top. And as a devout Muslim, had an absolute freak out until EA Sports removed it via patch.
I wish we'd been able to get into the caucuses more, because it's, you know, a fucking fascinating element of our sport. It doesn't go as deep into the class analysis as the analysis of American and especially Brazilian participants go into. But
Chechnya's warlord still bankrolls an enormous amount of fighters, and, you know, oh, like some guy from World Series of Fighting, a third-tier promotion, Magomed Bibilatov, won a title. Oh, here's him on Instagram with a brand-new Benz that Ramzan Kadyrov bought.
Yeah.
Like...
No, it's amazing. And, you know, one of the big things we talk about on this show is Saudi and Qatari influence all over the world. So you sort of see this echoed in Caucasian MMA, where the reason that Khabib Nurmagomedov, that you will never see his wife's face, that they try to keep his interviews in Russian and of our dialect out of American media, is because this guy has Salafist views. Why does he have Salafist views? Because Saudis poured in a shitload of money for Wahhabist ministries in Chechnya before and during the Second Chechen Civil War that caused many Chechens to slip from traditional Chechen Sufism and Dagestani Sufism to closer to Wahhabism and Salafism. But the tradition of Saudis and Qataris giving people, extremely tough people with nothing, more money than they have ever seen in their lives, continues in the MMA sphere, where there are stories, sort of unconfirmed, but pretty likely stories of Emirati sheikhs and Qataris just gifting mansions and cars to Dagestani and Chechen fighters who in previous generations, they changed their landscape by introducing Salafism to their, if you go by the Russian federal system, autonomous federal zone.
And so now, when Habib Nurmagomedov trains in America at American Kickboxing Academy in San Jose and showers up after, he wears swimming trunks because only Allah and his wife can see his genitals.
Once again, I want to thank Jordan Breen of the Sure Dog Network. Thank you, Jordan, for coming on the show. We'd love to have you back another time to talk about more just violence and stuff. Maybe we could talk about violent movies as well.
We wanted to talk about Predator, but like because Tomas has a migraine. Because last time I saw Tomas when Matt was in town, we talked about fucking Predator for like 5 hours.
I got so much to say about Predator. I was excited when you brought it up. I think it is unquestionably, in terms of everything an action film is supposed to represent,
it's a perfect movie.
It really defines the genre. It defines Arnold, and the trivia and drama around it, the physical toll that it took on like being in the jungle and getting attacked by leeches and scorpions, and Arnold like needing IVs every day because he like refused to eat the food in Mexico. It's insane.
No, Jordan, please come back and we'll do a whole Arnold show.
Oh, that would be fucking amazing.
Okay, we are back. Once again, that was Jordan Breen of the Sure Dog Network. And thanks again to him for coming on. Okay, so moving on. Like I said before the break, I rediscovered this thing this week. It is something called Do You Live in a Bubble? And it's one of these like online quizzes like they have at, you know, BuzzFeed or anything, these sort of like click things. But this one is a 25 question quiz that is based on Charles Murray's 2012 book, Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010. And I saw this because Charles Murray himself was tweeting out a link to it and asking people to take the quiz so he can have a larger sample size for his data. And unfortunately, I couldn't respond suck my dick to every one of these questions. So
the best part about this book is that this ties into what we talked about when we talked about Kevin Williamson, is you've got these conservatives who are dealing with this collapse of community among lower class whites in the last 30 years. And since they can't reckon with the reality, which is, you know, the fucking economy basically was put in the hands of a global financial capitalist elite that just basically allowed it to be destroyed, they basically instead decided to theorize that essentially blackness is contagious. And because poor white people aren't spending enough time around richer white people who give them antibodies against blackness, they catch the blackness. So for Murray and Williamson, and also I should add David Brooks, the prescription for these, you know, destroyed heartland communities is for these people to mingle more so that they can defend their bodies can defend against the black pathogen.
Yeah, but before we get into this, I feel like we should introduce Charles Murray for maybe people who don't know him. Charles Murray is a sort of very right-wing, I guess you would say, social scientist. He's the type of person who someone like Jonah Goldberg routinely describes as a genius. Like, he's the type of, like, a fucking Jonah Goldberg, who's probably one of the dumbest people alive, talks about Charles Murray the way I would talk about, I don't know, Stanley Kubrick or, like, the Coen brothers. He's a guy that really impresses, like I said, people like Jonah Goldberg.
He's basically, because the joke about Newt Gingrich is that he is a dumb person's idea of a smart person. Charles Murray is a dumb person who thinks he's smart's idea of a smart person.
Charles Murray he's lived a fascinating life. Charles Murray grew up in Iowa, where the angriest people in America live. As a boy, Charles burned a cross on a black neighbor's lawn, claiming he did not know of the racial animus behind this action. Charles later went on to publish studies linking race to IQ.
That's what he's most famous for, is this book that he wrote, The Bell Curve, that is, of course, beloved on the right and, you know, among the Andrew Sullivans of the world. He was the first person to publish it in the New Republic.
Let's not forget Will Salatin.
Yeah. Because it proves, they believe it essentially proves that blacks are genetically, intellectually inferior to white people.
So, like, you guys this year, you've probably seen a lot of fat fucks like Rick Wilson, Jonah Goldberg, and Eric Erickson decry Donald Trump for his unsophisticated and wild racism. And you ask, what does proper racism look like? What does respectable racism look like to these crying infants who are only kept from being homeless by endless pits of dark money? Well, it's Charles Murray. Charles Murray is the thinking man's Donald Trump.
Yeah, they're like, there's the Schlitz malt liquor of racism represented by Trump. And then there is the fine vintage Cabernet Sauvignon of racism represented by Charles Murray.
Before we get into this, Felix, you mentioned the anecdote about how Charles burned a cross on a hill in the town he grew up in Iowa. I want to mention one other thing from Charles Murray's past before we get into this delightful little quiz he's concocted.
The Phoenix Project?
From 1965 to the early 70s, he was with basically this it was something called the American Institutes for Research that was essentially a counterinsurgency program fronted by academics, by anthropologists in Thailand during the Vietnam War. And what they did was essentially use what they had studied and learned in the social sciences to better understand how to break, manipulate, and terrorize villages that they thought might go communist in rural Thailand, including things like using starvation, assassination, all kinds, but like with this kind of academic pseudo-psychological tilt about, you know, the Asian villagers' minds and how best they could be broken and manipulated to serve U.S. policy in the region. And there's one other thing connected to this, and this is an article written in 1994 about Charles Murray when the bell curve was first breaking, and he became like a national figure because a lot of very wealthy right-wing people put a ton of money into promoting him and making him seem like some kind of, you know, genius. This is an article. They mention his, you know, the years he spent as a young man in Thailand. I'm quoting now from the New York Times article. What then took place in Bangkok? Quite a lot, it seems, since his friends from those days still tell tales of Murray's barroom antics, one that he nostalgically repeats. Murray explains that he and a Peace Corps friend once sat for 12 hours at a place called the Patpong Terrace, interviewing bar girls as they returned from their liaisons, taking, quote, all sorts of intimate notes about who did what that I don't care to repeat. The resulting document became an underground thriller among his friends. The article continues. Murray also makes clear that he did more than take notes, though he theatrically objects to hearing the women described as prostitutes. Don't use that word, he says. They were women of the evening, courtesans. We liked them and they liked us. Murray continues. In a lot of places, you had to woo the ladies, he continues. It involves money on the man's part, yes, but it also involves consensual relations.
Holy shit, dude, this is Carl Digler talking about using webcams.
He says he understands that he is describing a pastime not usually associated with a defense of the two-parent family, but Murray says, I'm trying to tell you I'm not against sex, he says, characteristically blunt. You, Murray concludes, should have been so lucky. So this is how he spent his youth. He spent his youth in Thailand, basically destroying one half of the country in the most really cold-blooded and venal way imaginable, as some sort of CIA front or Christ knows what else. And then spending his nights paying to fuck the women who would probably starve otherwise, and thinking that he's wooing them in like some kind of Lothario or fucking ladies man.
So he's the guy.
Yeah, Charles Murray. A wonderful, wonderful human being. Oh yeah, and then when he came back to America in the late 80s, or no, in the early 80s, he jumped on the scene again, pushing the Justice Department hard to incarcerate vastly more people. Murray, everybody. And now here's the funny thing is that in this quiz, Charles Murray is going to be the judge of whether us three are out of touch with average white America. And I'll leave it to you, the listener, to decide for yourself whether these questions betray your or our removal from mainstream American culture or Charles Murray's.
All right, we got 25 questions. You guys ready?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. First question. Have you ever lived for at least a year in an American neighborhood in which the majority of your 50 nearest neighbors did not have a college degree?
How the fuck are you going to know that?
Yeah, how the fuck would anyone know that?
This is typical. It's like, well, you can just tell. This is Charles Murray's. Like, you can look. You look at the lawns and you can tell.
Well, if you burn a cross near their house and they know that it's a Klan symbol, they probably went to college. That's why Charles was doing that in the first place.
It was a sign that the collegiate people did to let each other know.
I lived in a trailer park for a while, so I'm going to go with yes for me.
Yeah,
I lived in a really shitty part of St. Paul, so I'm going to put yes.
I would say in my current neighborhood, I would probably also say yes. All right, so that's question two. Did you grow up in a family in which the chief breadwinner was not a managerial position or a high prestige profession defined as attorney, physician, dentist, architect, engineer, scientist, or college professor?
No, my dad was the chief racism officer at Raytheon. So no.
Yeah, no, my dad was the chemist who invented Agent Orange.
Oh, wow.
I gotta say yes on that one. Yeah, I never. There's not a lot of professionals in my family.
Okay, but two against one here, so I'm going with no. Question three: have you ever lived for at least a year in an American community with a population under 50,000 that is not part of a metropolitan area and is not where you went to college?
I have not.
I have not either.
I grew up in a relatively small town in northern Wisconsin.
Matt. Fucking in touch.
I grew up on older
but once again, Felix and I not.
I'm already telling how this is going to go, and we're going to find out what I already suspected, which is that I'm really the only proletarian on the Chapo Trap House.
But I mean, don't you think this is kind of a bullshit question? Because it's like you're in a bubble if you live in a city. So like, do those people in fucking South Side of Chicago or the West Side or like fucking most of Crown Heights, they don't know the real America. Like, dude, this is what Charles Murray does. Is he takes
but there aren't any poor white. What he's talking about is connection between white America and the poor people and the working class people in big cities are not white for the most part. So that's why he's thinking it that way. White poor people, white working class people live in exurbs and suburbs and in rural areas. Because this is all about his neurotic obsession with trying to, like I said, give richness antibodies, what our friend Ross Douthat calls bourgeois values of thrift and diligence, to the great unwashed whites, because they can be reached because they're on the right part of the bell curve. All those blacks and browns in the cities cannot. They're beyond help. They're past care.
Question number five. Have you ever walked on a factory floor? Now, this is an odd question because it's not, have you ever worked on a factory floor? Have you ever walked on a factory floor? To that, I can definitively say yes.
Yes, I am actually John Kerry, who ran for president in 2004. I walked on the floor of the dick-sucking factory in Des Moines, Iowa. And I said, whom amongst us has not sucked one off of the assembly line?
Have you ever – question number six. Have you ever held a job that caused something to hurt at the end of the day?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was a foreclosure lawyer, I would cry in my car at the end of the day.
Well, Charles actually has a caveat. Charles has a caveat for this question because he says the question applies to any part of the body that hurts because of physical labor using the large muscles. Headaches don't count. Neither does carpal tunnel syndrome, nor does a sore rear end from sitting all day in front of a computer screen.
I did fuck up my back at the lumberyard, and I also got bit on my bouncing job, so.
Yeah, and I was on the truck crew at a in high school. I was on the truck crew of at a grocery store unloading the thing, so that hurt like fuck.
My ass hurt from all the spankings I do as a professional sub.
Okay, so it's being revealed that Will is the soft boy.
You know, your ass is the largest muscle in the body. Question seven. Have you ever had a close friend who was an evangelical Christian?
I had a close friend who was a Jehovah's Witness. Does that count?
I think that probably does count.
Yeah, no, so I knew a shitload of, like, Jehovah's Witnesses kids, so yes.
But were you friends with them?
Yeah, fuck yeah, I was.
I had a friend's mom who was a Jehovah's Witness. Okay, that, I'm saying yes. Follow-up question, are you an evangelical Christian yourself? Yes.
No.
Question 8. Do you now have a close friend with whom you have strong and wide-ranging political disagreements? And it says, answer no if they are disagreements within the same side of the political spectrum. So he's, you know, I can't say, you know, like it doesn't count if we have...
Between communists and socialists.
Yeah, communists and socialists or Trotskyists and, yeah. I'm going to say no because... Yeah. Those there are conceivably conservative. I have friends who are Republicans or conservatives, but I'm friends with them because I've like known them since kindergarten. Like, and I'm not making any. I'm not taking any new applications for like you know libertarians to hang out with. So I'm going to say no for this one.
Yeah, they're tedious lamos. I'm not doing that.
Question 9: Have you ever had a close friend who could seldom get better than C's in high school, even if he or she tried hard?
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
No, I only hung out with dorks. the pure resin of nerddom.
Matt, the next question
is about Magic the Gathering, actually.
Dude, I had a friend in high school who has so many Magic cards that he told me that he could use them as collateral on a loan.
Question number 10. During the last month, have you voluntarily hung out with people who were smoking cigarettes?
I hung out with Felix.
I've hung out with Felix many times. Yes.
You're welcome, guys.
Hope your parents aren't listening to this, Felix.
I only have one parent, bitch. That was the idiot.
Ooh. Owned. Now, this one, I don't know how we're going to do over the radio, but it's a bunch of military insignias. And it says, do you know what the military ranks are denoted by these 5 insignias?
Click. Can you tell an AK-47 from an AR-15, pussy?
And the answers are none, at least one, all 5, and then the last is have served in the armed forces.
Master Sergeant, Lieutenant Colonel, Sergeant, I think that's Second Lieutenant, and I think Petty Officer?
Metal Gear Solid coming through again.
Yeah, motherfucker. Yeah.
So I'm clicking have served in the armed forces for this one because Felix has beaten all the Metal Gear Solid games.
Yeah, it's as good as being a veteran.
Okay, question 12. You have 2 options for this question. Answer whichever you're more comfortable with. The first of which is, do you know who Jimmy Johnson is? And the second is, have you ever purchased Avon products? Okay, bitch, let me ask you this. Which Jimmy Johnson are you referring to?
Yeah, the NASCAR driver? NFL, yeah,
or the NFL coach?
Yeah, bitch.
Question 13. Have you or your spouse ever bought a pickup truck?
No, I've never bought a fucking pickup truck.
Question 14. During the last year, have you ever purchased domestic mass market beer to stock your own fridge?
What a fucking asshole.
You know what? I'm going to be dead ass honest with you here. No, because I'm not in fucking college anymore.
Yeah, I only enjoy an Imperial Scotsman's Fallacy Epic Fuck Bacon IPA Pilsner. That's all I drink.
I'm not really a drinker. I am a K2 man. Next question.
Question 15. During the last 5 years, have you or your spouse gone fishing?
I've gone fishing, but now I don't have a spouse.
I think it's saying either one can. So if you went, that's a yes.
Yeah, in the last bitch. 5 years.
My spouse went fishing without me, or at least she told me she was.
Man. Will, can I email your spouse?
It sounds like your spouse was fishing for the well-known and delicious cuckold fish.
All right, this one is also difficult. The question 16 says, how many times in the last year have you eaten out at one of the following restaurant chains? Let's go down the list. Fellas, Applebee's.
Once.
Once.
Waffle House.
Four times.
God damn, I wish I had Waffle House up here.
Waffle House is good, yo. Waffle House kicks shit out of IHOP and Denny's. Like, that's the thing. So next is Denny's. I got none.
Okay, IHOP.
I got none because I got fucking Waffle House. I'm not going to IHOP when there's Waffle House.
Chili's.
I haven't been there this year.
Outback Steakhouse.
Yes, no. I have been to Outback this year.
Ruby Tuesdays.
Never. No. I've never been there.
TGI Fridays.
I think once.
Also never been there.
Ponderosa Steakhouse.
I used to go there all the time as a kid.
Get the fuck out of here with that elsewhere ass name.
I love the Ponderosa Steakhouse. I went there like every Friday as a kid, but not
I'm clicking one for that just based on Matt's affection for the restaurant.
Matt loves it enough for all of us.
Matt is actually wrecking the curve on this because I have not been to any of these restaurants in the last year.
Yeah, because I'm a fucking goddamn salt of the earth. You fucking effete urbanites.
Yeah, dude.
Thank you, Charles Murray.
Will grew up being like, oh, let me go to La Poisson Rouge on 805th Street where maybe I can see Richard Yates ordering the fucking Australian bull penis. Nah, bitch, this is that real shit. We're eating at Waffle House, bitch. White Americans can be just as good as the rich kind.
In question 17, in high school, did you letter in anything? Answer yes if you got any high school varsity letter that wasn't for the debating team or chess club, or if you were a cheerleader or in the marching band. So I just need to break the quiz for a second. Basically, what this entire, or at least half of these questions are asking is, were you alive in the 1950s?
Hold on, though. I did medal in junior high, but it was in drama. When I got it at the end of the year presentation, and I was really embarrassed, and I tried to hide it because I thought my dad would think I was gay. So there's a little cush bomb psychodrama for you. Some formative
question
moments.
Question 18. Have you ever attended a meeting of the Kiwanis Club, Rotary Club, or Union Local?
Are you 70 years old? Are you from Pleasantville? Was that your life?
No, Mr. Murray. I have never shared a malt. I'm not 90, you old racist bitch.
Question 19. Have you ever participated – oh, this is a really good one. Have you ever participated in a parade not involving global warming, a war protest, or gay rights?
Yes.
The sub is even better. It says, helping to decorate a float counts even if you didn't get to ride on it. I stitched flowers on the Viet Cong May Day parade.
So little childhood trivia. As I record this from the TV room in my mom's house in Chicago, when I was 8 years old, me and my best friend Derek, who is Greek, we were extremely tan, and there was a Puerto Rican parade going on in Chicago. And for whatever reason, they couldn't get 8 year olds to carry the banner. So they got me, the Jewish kid, and Derek, the Greek kid, to pretend to be Latino and carry the banner. So I led the parade, so that should count for like three.
That actually doesn't count because it also doesn't count if it was the parade was ethnic in any way. Question 20. We're in the home stretch here. Since leaving high school, have you ever worn a uniform? And it says, wearing a uniform in a dramatic production or on Halloween does not count.
A, I had a uniform for when I bounced at a bar, and B, I'm part of a little organization called the SA.
A nice brown shirt. I worked after college at a hamburger stand, and we had white jeans and a white shirt and a paper fucking hat, so that definitely counts.
What the fucking hamburger stand made you dress up like Tony Montana?
It was like for the 50s.
And there's a follow-up question.
I only worked there briefly, and I got accused of stealing a $100 bill, which I didn't do. And the cop incompetently interrogated me. And then they fired me. But I had put the uniform on, and I was really pissed because I had to go on and take it off before I could leave.
And then the follow-up to this question is, did you do so as part of your job? And the answers, options are yes while serving in the armed forces, and no. So typical spook that he is, with this quiz, Murray is just trying to suss out probably the best candidates for wet work, I think. People without a conscience, yeah, without experience in the armed forces.
He's trying to find the new Michael Weiss. The current Michael Weiss is getting old.
You know, it's sort of like a dark version of Last Starfighter. Somebody finishes this test, and they walk outside, and they get, like, black bagged and turned into Jason Bourne.
Okay. Question 21. Have you ever done either of these for a trip of 50 miles or more? And the options are ridden on a long-distance bus, e.g. Greyhound or Trailways, or B, hitchhiked.
Yes to the bus, no to the hitchhiking. I take a mega bus all the time.
Yeah, and I'm the fucking bus champion.
Question 22 of 25. Which of the following movies have you seen at a theater or on a DVD? Let's go through it, folks. Star Wars, The Force Awakens, saw it.
Didn't
Jurassic
see it.
World, saw it. Didn't Avengers, see it. Age of Ultron, saw it. Didn't Inside it. Out, did not see it.
What if I didn't see Star Wars The Force Awakens because of white genocide reasons? Because of the white cuckball. Will Charles give me points?
Plus 50. This is the next one is about TV. So just bring it up here. Empire. Never seen it. The Big Bang Theory. You seen it? Okay. The Big Bang Theory. Never seen it.
Never.
Modern Family. Never seen it.
I've watched it.
Okay. Scandal. Never seen it. Okay.
Yeah, you give me my Moscato and my fucking gelato. I'm on Scandal, like, girl, throwing shade. Kermit.
The Voice.
Nope.
Nah.
How to Get Away with Murder.
No.
No.
The Blacklist. Okay, it's my great shame I have seen that show at least once. Grey's Anatomy. Criminal Minds.
I have seen that, yeah.
Criminal Minds.
No.
Once Upon a Time.
No.
Yeah. Not so in touch with television.
Yeah, I don't
have you
really
ever
watch
watched an episode of any of these shows all the way through? Not just counts if it's just on in the background. Wendy Williams.
No. Yes, actually.
Dr. Phil.
Yes.
No.
Ellen.
No.
No.
Check this box if you watch any of them regularly. No. Oh, God. This is the last question. This is 25 of 25, and it's probably the best one. What does the word Branson mean to you? A big entertainment center in the Midwest. B, Richard Branson. Or C, no idea. I think Charles Bronson.
Yeah,
Charles.
Bitch.
So I'm going to say no idea.
When I hear
well,
Branson,
clearly he's goosing
I
you.
I do think of the town.
Yeah, I think of Branson. I know, he's clearly goosing you to think of the town Branson. And then if you click that, the follow-up question is, have you gone to Branson yourself? So... scoring, sort of all of us combined, we got 49 points. And it says the higher you score, the thinner your bubble. And the lower the score, the more insulated we are from, quote, mainstream American culture. So we are, with all of our answers combined, we were right about in the middle.
Yeah.
But if we're going to bell curve this out, you know, Matt, you would definitely be more in the mainstream. And I would probably
Hell
be...
yeah, bitch.
On the other side of that graph.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Makes,
yo.
Completely
Felix
insulated.
Felix is the delicious room temperature porridge.
Yeah, guess what, bitch? It's like this Matt and Trey say, the answer, the truth is in the middle. Fuck you.
Well, now we're all ready to go out and rub our first generation upper middle classness all over the poor whites so that we can finally get together and destroy the browns and the blacks.
Let's
as
do
Charles
it, bitch.
Murray envisions.
But as we said, coming back to the beginning of this, in all this discussion about the crisis of the working class, the fact that nobody has any fucking money never seems to come up in all of these
That's
obscure
secondary.
Cultural trivia that he seems to be so interested in.
You get the blackness on you, and then that makes you have kids out of wedlock, and then that's where you don't why you don't have any money. It's,
yeah, this entire essay, it like shows that Charles Murray is the same as like the BuzzFeed people who are like, vote for Beyonce, because his politics are all consumption now too. He's just like a racist version of the Beyonce people.
I'm like, looking forward to the election when Beyonce versus Jimmy Johnson.
Well, we should do, I think we should do our own version of this quiz. And like the question should be like, did Tony Stewart murder a guy with his car? Yes or no?
Or like, is, do you consider Gulan a traitor?
Is pee in the A, bladder, B, balls?
Are you in an open relationship? You click yes. Follow-up question. Are you currently turning tricks for your woke girlfriend to support her with your money?
Follow-up. What is her email?
Yeah. Hell yeah. We need to do one of these quizzes, but it's all just an elaborate honey trap to get people's wives' emails.
Yeah.
What do you say, dude? Who amongst our listeners knows how to program one of these quizzes?
I'm sure there's somebody. I mean, we know that they're all basement-dwelling incels. One of them knows the computers better than us.
Okay. Putting it on the to-do list, go to Politicon 2017, create elaborate ruse quiz to get people's emails, wives' emails, rather.
Normalize fascism.
Yes, and that's at the top of the list. So that is episode 20. I think that about does it for this week. But before we go, we should just plug again the live show in Philly at the end of the month on July 28th. You can buy tickets for it now, and you can buy t-shirts for it now. We will be posting the link through which you can do both of those things in the info for this show. We'll share it on our social media and Facebook, Twitter, whatever. Please signal boost, and please come out to the show on the 28th. If you are in Philly, the Northeast, or if you have marched in a parade in uniform within the last year.
Finally, if you were a member of the Phoenix program, you do get in free. We honor our heroes.
Anybody with a necklace of ears gets in for free.
That's you, Bob Carey.
Professor Dean Bob Carey, I should say. Nerdlinger. All I got to say to Charles Murray is I may be in the bubble, but it's that bubble kush, bitch. Stay high every day, motherfucker.
All right, everybody. Peace.
Till next week.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Famous and influential books. None of them is more controversial than The Bell Curve, which came in 1994, written with our dear friend Richard Herrnstein, and greeted with the kind of applause that that brave men sometimes have to endure.